and welcome to the Front Porch. My name is Rick Wilson. Scott Finn, our usual host, is slacking today, so we're going to try to work it ourselves. With me is my host, Lori Lynn of the Charleston Daily Mail. Hi, Lori.
Hi, Rick.
And I have a special guest today, a friend of mine, Jennifer Hill, who lives in Huntington, West Virginia. But she's here for a special reason because we're coming upon the 10th anniversary of Hurricane Katrina. And Jennifer happened to live in Kayville when it all went down and wound up in West Virginia. And this is some of the stories we do on the Front Porch. West Virginia doesn't come off looking terribly well, but this is one where we look pretty good, guys. So I'm going to kick it over to Lori a little bit and we'll get started.
Jennifer, before we talk about how you ended up here in West Virginia, yes. I think Rick and I are very interested to hear what your experience was like 10 years ago. You ended up in the Superdome. Can you just kind of walk us through how that happened?
Sure. I love to tell the story. 10 years ago this week, I was working with United Way for Greater New Orleans, and I was basically the Girl Friday, so running around for all the campaign managers and the execs. So by Friday, they were starting the doom and gloom weather reports. And at that point, native New Orleanians who typically ride them out or hunker down, as they love to say, we stopped listening to the news because it's literally like the Grim Reaper standing in front of you saying, you know, you better run, you're all going to die. And you couldn't take that particular warning every time it happened. Economically, you just couldn't afford to run every time a storm passed. But by Friday, we had a major event for our government workers. I was at the helm of that. And I remember getting off at early that Friday afternoon, maybe at 2 or 3 o'clock, and going home. My mom, for some reason, was at my apartment, which usually meant I got a good dinner. And so I was excited about that. And she looks at me because she'd been watching the news. And she turns to me and she says, "It seemed worse this time. What do you think?" And I was exhausted. And I was also a little bit anxious and nervous. And I didn't know what to do. So I said, "Turn the television off. Just turn it off. We know what they're going to say. You know, they always say it. They said it the last time and all we had was a couple of leaves blow off the porch and we had a little bit of rain hitting the window panes. You know what? Let's just not worry about it right now." So that was Friday afternoon and I put myself to sleep Friday. And I think that's utter denial, although there was like this nagging pit feeling in the pit of my stomach. Saturday morning was when the panic maybe started to really set in. And Saturday morning, it was me getting phone calls from my friends who I worked with or, you know, hung out with, all who had been typical ride out type of natives, were calling and saying, "I have a bad feeling." And that's what it was. It was a lot of premonitions of spoke of emotions and feelings. I have a bad feeling about this one. This one, I just don't feel comfortable. We're leaving. And my friend Tanya called and said, "Me and my mom are going." And that struck, for some reason, that struck me really hard. I'm like, she normally stays for everything. So if she's wanting to pack up and run, she's like, "My mom has a bad feeling about this. What are you going to do?" And I'm like, we didn't have a car. I didn't know how to drive. I didn't have to with mass transportation. So I was kind of at a loss in my mind and not thinking straight. I'll be the first to admit it. Of a plan, if we should need to go, how will we proceed? And so I said, "Well, I guess I'm just gonna ride it out my apartment." She's like, "Jen, I just don't feel comfortable." I remember those words specifically because I remember that pit that pit at the bottom of my stomach just kind of grew heavier.
But at that point, there was no mandatory evacuation.
No,
there was
so
no mandatory. Was that Sunday when
that probably would have been Sunday morning? Which, in essence, if you think about it, is almost too late for a mandatory evacuation because if you haven't prepared yourself, if you hadn't got your car gassed up, if you didn't have a ride, it's Sunday. I didn't even think about renting a car, but that would have been impossible at the time on a Sunday. The way things run, as I remember them, it was almost as if on Saturday, all mass transportation stopped. They stopped planes out. They stopped trains out. They stopped buses out. So if you didn't have it in your mind Saturday, by the time the mandatory evacuation hit, you were just literally, "I guess I just have to do the best I can." And so if I jump to Sunday morning, all of my friends are now telling me they're leaving. So I feel very alone outside of the fact that I have my mom and my brother in the apartment, in my apartment, which is a lovely apartment. It was the bottom floor of a 2-story wood frame house, very high up. So we didn't have a fear of flood waters. I never had a flood take place while I was living there. But then they're starting to talk about how bad the winds from this hurricane are. And they're saying no matter what side you're on, wet or dry, which in hurricane lingo for natives, if you're on the dry side, you're on the better side. They're saying no matter what, these winds were just whipping and they were going to be horrible. And so the first routine that you do right before you just close your doors, shut your windows, and hunker down, is you go to the nearest store and find out who has their ice cream on sale, because assuming they'll lose power, they'll sell it to you cheap. So kind of like a humorous prep. I asked my mom if she wanted to walk over to Walgreens, and we'd get some ice cream and some ice just in case we lost the power, which we figured we would. And we did, and there were people there that probably were the last minute, let's get the heck out of Dodge, because now we know it's going to be really, really bad. I don't know. I think that reaffirmed my fear, and that reaffirmed the panic, and it reaffirmed my helplessness at that time. So I remember getting the ice, getting some ice cream, going back to the apartment with a newspaper that said basically doom is happening, and looking at my mom and my brother, and she's like, what do you think? And I'm like, I don't think we can stay here. Now it's 9 o'clock on Sunday morning, and I'm thinking, what other options do we have? But I don't think we could stay here. And my fear was, with those winds in a wood frame house, it would just blow us apart. So I was like, well, it said because of mandatory evacuation, the Superdome was now opening as the last resort if you had nowhere else to go. And literally, it was walking distance from our apartment because I didn't live that far from the central business district. So I said, let's just pack a few things and we'll head up there. And it's a safer building. It's stronger. It's going to last. And this will blow over, and it'll maybe be power outages, trees down, maybe a little bit of water. We assume some would happen. And then we'll be home probably by Monday night. So then we walked, prepared ourselves. Each of us had a backpack. And it's strange that I always think what I brought in my backpack. I brought a change of clothes and I brought a book, because I figured I'll have to wait it out. So I might as well prepare myself to deal with, you know, the crazies. My brother bought his CD player. So he had music. And my mom, I think, brought a magazine or a book or something.
What was the book?
You know, I don't remember. I don't
remember.
She
probably wasn't reading
it. And you know what? I was like almost the Walking Dead at that point in time. I was a little bit numb, because it was like I realized what was happening, and there was some understanding that this would not be like the others. We'd never gone to another evacuation center ever. I'd always stayed at my house. And so even the idea of preparing to go someplace strange and to hang out with strangers, even if it wasn't just family, I think I was going through the motions of breathing and living and hoping to the in the best possible way we would be returning that night. But something told me we weren't. There was that feeling that we weren't. It was settled there.
So you left your apartment then on Sunday, and mm-hmm. then when was the next time you saw your apartment?
I would see my apartment again on the news.
Oh boy.
On Labor Day morning when we were in Huntington, mm-hmm. and there were fires all over the Lower Garden District, and that's where I stayed, and they were saying that they couldn't contain the fires because there was no water or water pressure, and so they were literally running buckets and trying to put out blazes, and I saw manic volunteer firemen running past an open field, and there was my apartment in the back, and it was fine. And so I sat in a hospital room with my mom, and I'm thinking, we've been through all this, and the apartment seems fine. However, at that point in time, there was a mandatory, everyone had to get out of the city because of the way the water was, the fires, and also just the dangers. Just they couldn't account for anything. It was like, was it martial law? Did they put that down? I think, yeah. And for me, that scene in the hospital was the first time I saw it as an observer. I was in it for a week, but I didn't see what other people saw. And I could understand now when people saw us for the first time or greeted us, they had this dazed look in their eyes, like, I can't believe you went through that. Or I sat in my bed crying the whole time this was going on, feeling helpless. And it wasn't until I saw those first scenes that I realized what it meant for somebody outside the experience.
So you wrote out the worst of the storm then that night in the Superdome. Mm-hmm. So take us through then that following week as things started to deteriorate in the city.
Sunday had a different feel from any other day, because Sunday it was those that were preparing for safety. Like we were just going there to have a safe place to stay. It wasn't necessarily a camp out feel per se, but there definitely wasn't an ominous feel to the people there. You know, we were just going to make the best of it. We're going to get through this. And then everybody goes back to their respective homes. So that would have been Sunday afternoon. We got there about 3 o'clock. We got checked through a checkpoint, bag searched, and then seated in the stadium seating. We stayed in the stadium seating up and until the storm hit. And that would have been, the storm hit about 5 o'clock in the morning, if I'm not mistaken. I know it was very, very early in the morning. So we're in the stadium seating, and there's estimate about 7,000-8,000 people there, you know, just spread around. And our city officials, and there were military, and there were news crews, and there were all sorts of other people kind of milling about on the football field. And when the storm hit, To understand where the Superdome is positioned in the city, it's in the Central Business District, which creates a wind tunnel. So we already knew the winds were going to be bad. We'd all heard the reports. We were all kind of keeping up on it. So we knew that we were going to hear from Matt. But it was magnified in that wind tunnel. You could hear, once it started blowing in about 4 o'clock, you started hearing things bursting and breaking. And the Hyatt Regency is connected to a plaza shopping center that's connected to the Superdome. And it's all glass. And so as the storm is hitting, every glass window is breaking. And so I to this day, if I hear glass breaking, it kind of sends a shiver through, because we had to listen to that for hours. There was a parking garage underneath the Superdome, and as the winds whipped, they were so strong, they were starting to smash cars against concrete pillars, so you're hearing that. But as hard as that was to hear, and as terrifying as that could have been, it was the ceiling peeling off the Superdome as the storm blew over us. And it was just a slow peel. It wasn't like ripping. It was just like you saw the split, and then you saw it slowly starting to peel back.
So you could see from inside that it was peeling. Wow.
It was blowing away. And then you could see water falling down. And it never was like a huge gaping hole in the ceiling. But what was the terrifying part of that was our city officials that were on the football field reacted to the peeling ceiling. And it was complete and utter panic. And, oh, my God. The ceiling's going, there's water coming in, and then we could hear it even in the stands, them saying, screaming, the generator is in the basement. And my thought was like, okay, we're below sea level. We've known this since the existence of the city. Why would you have built a basement, number one, and then why would you put the generators in the basement? So when that was said, maybe it was a good thing that I heard it. I prepared myself, and I even told my mom and my brother, I'm like, the lights are going to go out. I mean, we lost general power early on, probably when the winds first started, but the generators had kicked in. So we had minimal light, enough to see, enough to feel a little bit more comfortable. But when they said that, I'm like, all right, prepare for the worst now. And it did. It just went dark. That was scary. You could still hear the winds. You could still hear the glass breaking. You could still hear the cars. There were people that were starting to panic and freak out, if you want to say it. That was the Monday morning. Then about Monday, I would say maybe about 1 or 2 o'clock, we moved from the stadium seating because of the water coming in to the basic like stadium runway where you could walk up to the different levels of seating. They wanted us there. Now, what was not so great about that was an enclosed space. There was no windows. You couldn't see outside, and you're just basically facing people. So that wasn't the best circumstance, but we tried to make the best of it. Those are still the people that came because we were just trying to have a safe place to stay. What would happen now is people would start surviving the storm and coming as a place of rescue. And so the atmosphere started to change as you started to get people in who had been in the storm, who were in their homes, who had lost family, who had lost their whole neighborhood. And you were starting to get their stories and like the story of, you know, things are just gone. Things are not. And I would say maybe from 1 o'clock in the afternoon till about 4 o'clock, we weren't hearing desperate stories. And it was about 4 o'clock that my mom said, it still seems kind of calm here. We aren't hearing any weather reports. We're not hearing any panic. Why are we still here? Can't we just leave? Because at that point in time, we knew we had the dry side of the storm. So that's the better side of a hurricane. And so she's like, well, if we got the better side, then shouldn't they be just letting us go? Shouldn't they let us go? And she had me stop a National Guardsman who was walking past, and she said, ask him why we haven't left yet. So I stopped, and I was like, politely, sir, hey, you know, when are they going to let us out of here? You know, things seem to be okay. And he's like, the city's underwater. You're not going anywhere. Well, we couldn't see it. We hadn't heard it. Nobody was telling us that for sure.
So you didn't have television?
No, nothing showing you? My brother had a battery-operated radio CD player, and we basically told him to conserve it because we didn't know at that point, I guess, how long we were going to be there or how low his batteries were. And so at that point in time when he said the city's underwater, we just kind of, whatever, go away. And then my mom asked him the question. She's like, where are you from? And he's like, Kansas. And she's like, he's not even from here. He doesn't know what he's talking about. Go find somebody else. And so when he walked off, I hit my brother and I was like, turn the radio on. I kind of want to hear if there's something going on. And he gave me his headphones. He's like, I don't want to hear. So I put it on. And I remember it was Garland Robinette, who is an awesome newscaster in New Orleans and radio host, was talking to Mayor Nagin. And he was asking him, what is going on? What do you see? And it was just the fact that every answer to every question from Nagin was, I don't know. And it was a sincere, I don't know. And it was just loss. And it was that pit at the bottom of my stomach, which never left, started to grow bigger and heavier. And it came down to him saying, I think Garland asked him, he's like, I'm hearing from reports from people calling in that there's water coming in their houses. And there's water in certain areas that is rising very fast, and they don't have any idea where it's coming from or if it stopped. You can stop. Do you know? He's like, I don't know. Do you
it was
know?
Almost like a slow motion thing that mm-hmm. day, wasn't it? I mean, mm-hmm. I remember waking up, and I was living in Washington at the time, and after all the hype over the weekend and yeah. watching, and it looked like, oh, well, there was a lot of wind damage, mm-hmm. but it looks like New Orleans is actually going to be okay. And then throughout the day, as the levees were breached kind of one after the other, it got worse and worse. But that morning, it seemed like maybe that they had gotten off better than they thought they had.
We had a feeling there that we'd escaped mm-hmm. something and that we were going to be all right. And there was the buildup that we probably wouldn't, but then it was like, oh, it was almost like a little bit of a sigh after all that noise and the ceiling peeling. You know what? In the end, the building's still standing. Obviously, everything seems to be okay. And then hearing that interview when he had no information, he just knew bad things were happening, and he started taking phone calls, and you could hear the desperation in people's voices. I'm on my second floor and the water's rising. And that struck me completely. That had never happened in my whole living experience in New Orleans through all the storms I've experienced there.
So can you take us through things deteriorated throughout the week, and then by Thursday you had said you were standing in a line to get on a bus to actually get out of the Superdome area and go somewhere else.
The Superdome population increased exponentially every day, and that was with the military branches rescuing people and bringing them there. There was such a huge amount of people that we had moved from the inside of the dome to the outside of the dome just to have some fresh air to breathe. And it was safer.
And there were stories about people running out of food and violence. And
The violence was there. And I don't want to stress it, but it was there even in the beginning. And I think it was just out of desperation. People just had no idea what was going on. And if there was a little bit of power to get a cell phone up and charge so they could tell somebody where they were, they'd fight for that right or fight for that privilege. And then it just kind of boiled over because of the situation. I believe people just in their own reactions lashed out at each other. I always say this to counter it. I saw the best in people and mm-hmm. I saw the worst in people. We had water, I would say, up until about Wednesday. I think our supply ran low and they started handing out commodity grape juice, which I always laughingly told people, don't drink it. It's just full of sugar and it'll only make you thirstier. But I would say about Thursday, they started bringing in more military supplies. So we had that. But then they realized, or they had started making arrangements that they needed to get us out of that one location and maybe dispersed and into other. We'd heard whispers that we were going to be on buses. We'd heard whispers for days that they were going to get us out. But by Wednesday, after being there for 4 days and you not moving and information was sketchy or it was misconstrued or it was just, you just couldn't count on anything being the truth.
Right, rumors, I'm sure.
Rumors abound.
Everywhere.
There was even the rumor that the Superdome inside had been set on fire once we'd moved outside. And that was a whole brand new set of panic. That was Thursday early morning. But finally, military crews came around and told everybody that was sitting outside to get up and get ready to get in line. And I know they've shown this picture, and there's this walkway that connects the Superdome to the shopping plaza, and there's just a sea of thousands of people on it. Well, that was the line. And I remember it being about 2 o'clock on Thursday. My family was told, let's get in the line. So 2 o'clock, me, my mom, my brother, and a lady we'd befriended, her daughter, they were tourists. Her and her daughter were there for a vacation. And we all got in the line together. And then about, I would say maybe 4 hours into it, we had moved. We had moved at all. And at that point in time, an announcement was made that they wanted to separate women and children on one side, the elderly in the middle, and men over 14 and over on the other side, like the right side of the plaza. And we're like, what's that going to do? And they're like, well, the men will have to wait. We'll get women and children out first. And I have to say, that was when I had one of my emotional breakdowns, because the idea of surviving it, at least I had my brother, I had my mom, we were together, we could talk it out, we could figure out what we were going to do, and now they were going to separate that unit. And basically, the only person that was going to leave it was my brother. And so I remember screaming and saying no, and him saying very maturely, if this is how we get out, this is how we get out, I'm going to be fine. And giving him my mom's cell phone number, even the cell contact was erratic. It was just, you couldn't count on it. But giving him the cell phone and saying that every once in a while, just check a message. I'll keep in touch. I'll try to call it and let you know what's happening, what's going on. I would not see my brother again until the following Thursday when we all were reunited in Huntington. So he he stood in line and he got out that Friday. My mom and I stood in line from that 2 o'clock Thursday afternoon up until 5 o'clock in the morning on Friday. We were up at the front of the barricades. The line started moving, I would say maybe about 10, 11 o'clock at night, where we actually could see people getting out of the crowd in a line, 50 at a time, mind you, and onto what they said were the buses that were going to take you away. We finally get up at about 5 o'clock in the morning, and it was supposed to just be women being let through, but when the barricades open, a group of guys rushed past us, and they were the 50 that were going to be taken. At that point, first time I felt it, there was this huge surge from the back because there were still thousands of people waiting to get out, and they were literally pressing us against the barricade, and it was the first time I really feared for my life. Like, I couldn't breathe. I knew my mom was weak and she couldn't breathe. She couldn't stand up much longer. I'd been holding her for a while, and I said at this point in time, it would be more important to get her out of that, able to breathe, and we regroup and figure out how we were going to get out. And we had been actually separated during that time period from the tourist Linda and her daughter Nicole. And so I was like, you know what, let's just go and find them and we'll settle down. And we did. We got out. We lost our place in line that time. And then the group of us made a decision that from then on we would just wait until things calmed down, people were less panicked to leave, and then we would see where we would end up as far as buses and getting out of the Superdome. My brother would get out, I'm told, when we were united. He got out about 3 o'clock that afternoon, that Friday, and my mom and I would not get out with a group of that we stayed with until 5 o'clock Saturday afternoon. So we would wait it out in a parking lot until the crowd dissipated a bit more, and actually it was the military that came to us and said, you know, it's time to leave, because we had settled down in a safe haven, a safety in numbers. There was a group of about 7 or 8 of us now. We had a little functioning system of used water as opposed to unopened water, and we were almost a comfort zone for people that were wandering. There were a couple of people that joined our group, a young boy and his girlfriend from Tennessee, a lady from Belgium that had gone through, experienced the storm outside. While I still only had the experience from inside the dome, they'd experienced all the horror that had happened with the flooding and walking past bodies and not knowing where to go at all for help. Some of them were unfamiliar to the city, so they had no idea what to look for as far as resources. So that was our little pot of, in our group. When we got out of the dome finally, there is a funny story that I call them funny stories. There are very interesting and nice stories in the midst of all this chaos and horror. And it actually goes back to why a lot of people probably didn't survive the storm. And that is, if you were a pet owner, or if you were elderly and didn't have a car, you were probably stuck wherever you were. And so there were a lot of people that would not leave their pets, and they would not just leave their homes at all because they didn't have cars like us. But a lady in that last group of people getting off the bus had a beautiful, and I still remember him, absolutely gorgeous St. Bernard. Very docile, very friendly dog. And she looked at us and she said she'd walked from her apartment and gotten to the dome. And she's like, I'm not leaving him behind. And we'd heard them say, that dog's not getting on a bus. That dog's not getting on a bus. Well, our little group steadfast said, we like that dog. He became a fighting and rallying point for us. And we're like, that dog's getting on the bus. And she's like, how? They've already told me they're not. She's like, if they don't let my dog, I'm not leaving the city. And so we said, I don't remember who in the group said it, he's your service dog. And we looked and we're like, huh? She's like, you're blind. He's your service dog.
I'm betting that was you.
You know what? In the delirium, it probably was me. And we came to the bus. We came up to the bus and the military guy came up. And the first thing he said was, that dog's not coming. And we looked at him and she's like, she's blind. She needs that dog. And there were so many of us screaming it at him that he just acquiesced and said, just go ahead. And she got on the bus and the dog and her got in the back and they just had the biggest grin. I swear the dog grinned too. I had the biggest grin. I don't know what happened to them once we got to the airport, but I was confident enough that we had saved that one little family. And that was a family. Yeah. That was her support. Once we got to the airport, it would take us another 12 hours in waiting and lines and handing out social security numbers every time somebody asked for it.
And then you got on a plane and you thought you were going to Texas, and yes, it turned out you weren't.
That was a moment that for the majority of the 12 hours, we had this one little guard that had been very nice to us and given us as much information as he could. And all I knew was my brother was in Texas, and if we got to Texas, we could reunite. And it was right before we boarded the plane that I asked the question, where in Texas will the plane land? Because I can figure out how to get to Dallas, where my brother was. And the guy looks, another military National Guardsman, I believe, said, this plane's not going to Texas. And I'm said, well, what? Well, where is it going? And he said, it's going to West Virginia. And I say this, I was fully aware in 2005 that West Virginia was a separate state. I knew that through my own education and through my own experience that Louisiana and West Virginia State are quite a few characteristics that in the news, but I just didn't know where the airport was.
Had you ever been to the state?
I'd never been to the state. I never visited. So he says West Virginia, and at one moment of just having that much misinformation for that much time, I flipped out about the idea of having to regroup my plane, not so much where I was going. My poor little military guy that had told me Texas all along started crying and saying that, you know, he had gotten a lot of decent information, and my group rallied around us again and said, we're not separating. So it doesn't matter if this plane is going to Texas or it's going to West Virginia. We're sticking together and we're going. And so we got on a C-130, I would say at about 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning. They told us that we're going to Charleston and it would take maybe about 2 hours for us to get there. But the weather would have it that fog was covering Yeager. We would circle, I believe, for about 45 minutes to an hour. And my mother and several other people on that plane needed so much medical care and medical attention that the Army nurse said, this plane cannot keep circling. We need to land. They need help. And they called in, and I believe Cabell Huntington Hospital answered the phone call. And they said, we'll have ambulances waiting at Tri-State. Don't circle anymore. Come to us. And so we landed at the Tri-State Airport. I remember it being extraordinarily cool morning. And after the awful, awful heat wave for that week, it felt so refreshing to feel that cold air. And I remember once we got in the ambulance, they started down the road from the airport to the hospital, and it's covered in green trees. And so that was my first experience of West Virginia, with a little bit of fog, a cool breeze, and a green trees. And I remember my mom being on the stretcher and saying, this doesn't look like a bad place, Jen. And I said, no, it doesn't. No, it doesn't.
So one thing, you know, West Virginians can sort of be proud of is that our state actually played a pretty good role in getting aid in there. Our governor at the time, Joe Manchin, now in the Senate, say what you like about Manchin, he does have a heart, and I think he really said move heaven and earth to get in there and get people out. Can you talk about that a little bit?
I can talk about it from once I lived in Huntington. I had the honor and the privilege of actually meeting Governor Manchin in 2006, I believe. And I had to express to him my gratitude, because while at that moment I wanted to be reunited with my brother, this actually is absolutely the best place for us. And it was positively the best place for us after that experience. I cannot tell you that once that plane landed in Huntington, the arms and the doors and that opened to us and that made us feel welcome, that has made this my home for the past 10 years, and it is my home. And that was part of the decision even of not returning. And it started with that decision that he must have made in the early morning hours once the call came out that Texas can't take everybody. And I would assume that had to come down. You know, they just couldn't accept all of the quote-unquote refugees. And so for him to say, we want them, was the first arm that opened up. And I don't, and I hazard to say that his welcoming spirit and his ability to open his doors and his state to us in the time of need and to make such a way for us, because there was such a way made for those of us that landed here and opportunities that were offered, that was kind of the example set, and the rest of the country could do the same. Because I would hear for months and months and months my friends saying, you know, I went to Arizona or I went to Virginia and they had all of their command stations set up and they understood. But for me, the first command station would have to have been outside of Texas, was West Virginia, because if I'm not mistaken, we were the first plane that did not go to Texas. That we were the first plane to go somewhere else, and it was here.
I know the state was commended by the CDC after that for, you know, coordinated disaster response. So, again, we look pretty good on that one. Huh?
You look very, very good on that one. And I can't state it enough that it's the warmth and the culture here that was just the balm we needed. I mean, there was a big wound we were experiencing. My whole family.
You had a backpack, you said, with clothes and a book. I mean, what did they do here in Huntington to help you get on your feet again?
The minute we landed, my mom was at the hospital and admitted, and she had so many things that needed to be addressed. And the hospital just bent over backwards to make certain that she got the care she needed, and I was ever so thankful for that. And the hospital in itself, Cabell Huntington, was the reason that we were reunited. Their staff made the effort to make certain that my brother would come here at no cost to me or my mom. And I was willing to pay the cost. I had it at the time, but they said, no, that after all you've been through, you shouldn't have to deal with that. Outside of that, there was an amazing social worker, which I think is the reason why I'm a social worker now, that like he laid our path out. He explained what the opportunities were as far as, you know, if you want to stay, this is where you may want to live. His wife is a professor at Marshall. I was able to take, my brother and I were able to take a tour just based on the fact that, like, come and see. That was what I saw. The want in West Virginians to say, come and see us. Look, look what we have to offer. And there is so much here, and there's so much to offer.
What was the name of the social worker?
Pete Ingram. Pete Ingram. And his wife is Professor Jody Gottlieb, fast friends of mine. And
in the social work department at Marshall, right?
In the social work department at Marshall. Okay. Well, that's my, I'm an alum, and I'm proud of it. I'm also an alum of WVU, so I'm a house divided within one person. And I champion both sides. But it's almost immeasurable. There were people that arrived the day that we arrived that offered us clothing. There were people that came just to wish us well and say they would pray for us the days after. There were cards sent in the mail that just said, we wish you the best, and we hope and pray that everything will work out for you. There were homes, and there was even horses offered. And, as I take a look back 10 years later, I wouldn't mind a horse ride, but there were horses. Everyone offered anything and everything they could, and it was the welcome we needed to see and feel in order to feel a little bit whole again. And we're still works in progress on that after all we've been through. But I don't think I could have survived as well if I had been any other place. I didn't have to fight for where I wanted to live. I didn't have to fight to uncover a plan for my future. There were decisions that were made, but they were almost made a lot easier. I currently work for Children's Home Society, and I met an employee the day after we arrived. She came to the hospital with magazines and homemade cookies and said, I just wanted to offer you this because I know you've been through a lot. And if you ever need a place to just run and hide or cry, she's like, I work right behind the hospital, and you can come to my place. And that just basically exemplifies what we've experienced since we've lived here. There's never been a time truly that a door's been shut.
Thank you for being here and sharing this amazing story with us 10 years out. You've been back a couple times, I think.
I've been back. I went once in November of 2005. That was to pack everything up and officially make West Virginia my home. So I've been a resident since 2005, officially.
She can
November.
Drive now, you guys. Watch out.
Yeah, you want to get off the roads because I just learned in 2007. So I'm just warning
you. You gotta have a car here.
You got to. Yep. You have to. And then I'm going to be returning in a week. So this will be the first time I've been back in 10 years. And I'm looking forward to
it. What do you miss the most?
What do I miss the most? I miss the seafood, but the BP spill may have something. I don't know how good it's going to be when I get back. I miss the sense of music on the streets. That was something. There was music everywhere you went. You felt it in your soul, your stomach, your heart, your head. And I can't wait. And also because I get to bring back a very special guest. My fiance is coming with me, David. And so he's never been before. So I get to play tour guide and show him what a native knows. And
that's something else you've managed to collect in West Virginia, too, right?
My dog?
Your fiance.
My fiance. Oh, good. Him first. I mentioned him first, didn't I? David Wells. Yes, I am going to be Mrs. Wells in a little bit. And I'm excited about that. And I have to say, if the arms hadn't been open and the situation hadn't happened, I would not have the love of my life. So,
score one for the hillbillies this time on the front porch.
Thank you so much, Jennifer. We really appreciate you joining us.
Thank you.
So that is Jennifer Hill, and Lori Lynn from the Daily Mail is here. I'm Rick Wilson, and party on, West Virginia.